G20 health ministers wrapped up in the Italian capital on Monday, ensuring sustainable development in a post-pandemic world and preventing future pandemics were among the issues discussed by the group. At the end of the meeting, Roberto Speranza, the health minister of Italy, which holds the G20 presidency this year, announced the unanimous adoption of the Pact of Rome and the pledge that the Group of 20 will make sure the world's population has access to COVID-19 vaccines.
Ma dobbiamo necessariamente rendere altre aree del...
We want to build the conditions to make it possible to take the COVID-19 vaccines to the most fragile countries. Furthermore, with the Pact of Rome, it was decided to make a commitment to reinforce the health systems.
Now that public health and social measures have been relaxed in many countries, COVID vaccination rates have slumped in some parts of the world, and authorities are worried. G20 health ministers have stressed that the public's vaccination is crucial.
The G20 talks have taken place against the backdrop of a flaming debate over the so-called Green Pass, a mandatory proof of anti-COVID vaccination. The Italian government is considering extending its Green Pass to all employees in the public sector, but part of the ruling coalition is against it.
The Italian government has already made the Green Pass mandatory for school staff and for passengers on long-distance public transport. This has prompted a swath of protests across Italy over the past months. About 37.5 million Italians, out of a population of less than 60 million, have received both COVID vaccine doses so far. Italian authorities aim at vaccinating 80% of the population by the end of September, a target that seems unlikely to be met. Max Civili, Rome.
The EU Rule of Law Report 2021 singles out Hungary, Poland, Bulgaria, Croatia and Slovenia for particular criticism. It reaches conclusions but provides zero recommendations.
It's toothless and spineless because what we have is a carefully worded partial account of threats to the rule of law without any joining of the dots, without any calling things out as they are.
The European Commission's Rule of Law report was published in July. This is the first opportunity members of the European Parliament, MEPs, have had to debate it. Some governments in the EU are accused of corruption, stifling media freedom, and interfering in judicial systems.
Such as Austria, for example, where public prosecutors responsible for high-profile corruption cases have been confronted with negative portrayals by government representatives.
Calls have been made for EU funding to be withheld.
No money from the recovery plan can be used by these oligarchs to further capture the state and further organise elections in their favour. We should be very, very serious about that.
Far-right EU lawmakers were criticised during the debate.
You protect a Hungarian autocrat who gives money to everywhere there in dark channels in corruption.
Legislators say EU governments are failing to ensure human rights and promote religious tolerance. It's a particular issue for Jews and Muslims.
For me, Muslims are two times victims. One, as a citizen like you and me, but secondly, because their religion is hijacked by extremists who make a horrible thing of it.
The European Commission has powers to enforce rule of law, but is accused of not using them.
It is a problem for all of us. It's a problem because this spreads. And also, it's a problem when the Commission doesn't manage to act properly.
Some MEPs are asking the question, why is it EU leaders are so quick to apply sanctions on foreign nations for alleged rule of law breaches, but turn a blind eye when one of their own nations steps out of line? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Lebanon is in a day of national mourning after the passing of head of the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council in Lebanon at the age of 85. Sheikh Abdel Amir Qabalan was viewed by those who knew him as not only a religious figure, but a national figure who strove for the best interest of the country.
Lebanon's problem doesn't lie in its religious or sectarian diversity, but in some corrupt officials who hide behind their sects and call on their followers to move away from their genuine belief. Sheikh Qabalan, along with other clerics, exerted all efforts to keep the sectarian diversity as national treasure. Lebanon cannot be a transit area for the Zionists or the U.S. It should be a symbol of resistance and national pride as he wanted.
The deceased cleric was known for his moderation and therefore his impact on mediating talks between Lebanese political groups.
The demise of Sheikh Qabalan comes at a critical time for Lebanon, which is unprecedented in Lebanon's history. Lebanon needs such figures at this stage. He was someone open to all sides in Lebanon, whether political or religious. He had always called for solving our internal crisis peacefully. Also, he was a supporter of the resistance.
In a statement, the Speaker of the Parliament, Nabih Birri, stressed that Ayatollah Qabalan followed in the footsteps of Imam Musa Sadr in moderation, coexistence, and resisting deprivation and occupation.
Ayatollah
Sheikh Qabalan's demise is a great loss for Lebanon and the Muslim world. We all know he was among the close companions of Sayyid Musa al-Sadr, and together they worked for the poor and the oppressed. They established the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council, which serves as a center for congregation and dialogue for all Lebanese. We pray that this sad occasion could push the Lebanese officials to put differences aside and quickly form a cabinet, since Lebanon is in dire need for an active government.
Caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab declared Tuesday the day of the funeral procession for the spiritual leader as a national holiday.
Throughout his life, Sheikh Qabalan called on everyone to preserve the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine. He also preached unity among the Lebanese and Muslims, a move which made him a mediator on many occasions. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
As the world battles extraordinary refugee crisis for decades, hundreds of Afghans who have arrived in India after the Taliban take over of their country, they have been protesting outside the UN refugee office in New Delhi, demanding refugee status, justice, and protection for their women and children. Experts say India is not a signatory to the 1951 UN Refugee Convention or the 1967 protocols relating to the status of refugees. Therefore, it would be a challenging task to deal with another refugee influx. In India, where internal migration has been one of the most challenging tasks for the country due to huge population and possible mismanagement of the refugee policies. Observers say another refugee exodus could be a hard job for the country, considering its complex bureaucratic registration process. They say the country needs a uniform refugee policy. As India has no specific program for refugees, it allows the UNHCR to operate a program for them. Based on reports, thousands of Afghans are registered with the UN Refugee Agency, but there are many who are still demanding the refugee status despite arriving in India a decade ago. Experts say now the new influx might compel India to rethink its refugee policy.
Like many other nations and countries, India is home to a large group of and large chunk of refugees who come from their countries of origin to seek protection. But the confusion arises when we come to the mechanism, how India governs its refugees. In India, they have not a sound mechanism which can deal and which can protect these minorities.
A decade ago, scores of Afghan refugees arrived in India, leaving their war-torn country. But they still have trouble in accessing basic services like education, healthcare, and employment. Many are now demanding financial assistance due to lack of income. Others say they would return to their country, but are skeptical and still reeling from the violent past.
I think we have no future as the whole world is silent on our plight. The memories of violence still haunts us. I have a refugee card, but it does not help me as it should as a refugee. I urge the UN and the international community to pay urgent attention to us. We are worried for our future as our fate remains uncertain.
Despite India's rich history of ties with Afghanistan and home to hundreds of thousands of refugees from across the globe, the country has no clear-cut policy for refugees or any domestic law. Experts say by framing a concrete refugee law, India would be able to appropriately protect the rights of refugees. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian sky.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust. From the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps. From the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the United States is anything but united these days. Inside the country lies much discontent and a major divide. And outside the country, even Washington's allies are starting to say that U.S. hegemony is waning rapidly, especially after the Afghanistan debacle. Are we looking at the beginning of the end of the American empire? Or are we rapidly approaching its dissolution? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this and more on this Spotlight.
Weeks after the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan, the world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport, where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people, including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower. But a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant. The United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.
While the U.S. threatens military action against nations it deems its adversaries, including Iran, Russia, and China, it appears that more Washington allies are beginning to take up the opinion that America has lost its superpower status.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight, Senior Analyst, Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams out of New York. And Journalist and Political Analyst, Elijah Mahnia out of Brussels.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off with Ian in New York. Ian, do you think that the U.S. is waning? And if so, when do you think this actually started? Some say from 1971, when gold no longer backed the dollar. Others say since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, what's your assessment of this overall?
It's very difficult to say. Oh, it's been waning almost the minute it was established, because people successfully stood against it. You could say that the Vietnamese victory against the U.S. was a clear signal. But it was definitely at its height after the fall of the Berlin Wall, after the fall of the Soviet Union, and with the Iraq War. The U.S. was unchallenged internationally. Even its enemies didn't really dare go against it. That's been eroded totally. But what happened in Afghanistan was not significant in economic or military terms. It was significant in terms of prestige, which, as far as global diplomacy is concerned, is almost as important. But people are still going to think twice before they challenge the U.S. They still have hugely disproportionate armed forces. They still have hugely disproportionate financial support, less so than it was, and it's definitely waning, and a lot less quickly than some of us would have hoped, perhaps. But it's also got rising, it's got rising rivals, in particular China. I don't really think that Russia is one of the major rivals. It's Russia is sort of Saudi Arabia with nuclear weapons. It doesn't have a massive economy, but it does have this residual armed forces and nuclear weapons. China is a rising power in every sense, and obviously the U.S. is scared about it. But once again, the U.S. isn't unrivaled there, and China can't really exploit the U.S.'s weakness, because one of the reasons why China has been rising is because it sells so much of its goods to the United States, and it borrows so much money from the United States. It lends so much money to the United States. So they're inextricably bound together. It's not a straight one-on-one superpower confrontation like Moscow and Washington in what you might say the bad old days, when they really didn't have that much to do with each other. There was almost minimal contact in culturally, financially, and other ways. But the United States is a victim of its own failures.
Let me. We're going to talk about the reasons for this, but let me get Elijah in on this conversation. Now, American political scientist Francis Fukuyama says that the truth of the matter is that the end of the American era had come much earlier. The long-term sources of American weakness and decline are more domestic than international. What do you think about that?
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming.
The decline of the U.S. forces started not when the U.S. was engaged in war, like in Lebanon 1982 or 1983, in Iraq in 2003, in Syria 2011. It is, what is the outcome of all these wars? Of course, the U.S. has the strongest military machine and military power, but what is the result of this machine? It winning the ground and then not be able to hold it. It's exactly the same as ISIS is able today to attack small villages and win and then withdraw. But the U.S. is able to stay for much longer, for many years, and then being kicked out and forced to withdraw. The moment the Americans sit with the Taliban and negotiate a peace deal is the moment of the decline and the defeat of the U.S. after 20 years. So there is no point for the U.S. to have so much the mighty military power when the result is very slim at the end of the day. So yes, it is a decline of the empire. It is the rising of other forces that not only are rival, but also are defying the U.S. and challenging the U.S. Forces, even if they don't stand to the exact U.S. Military power. And they have a minor force, but however they can and they are able to defy the U.S. Like we've seen that in Iran, we've seen that in Syria, we've seen that in Lebanon, and we've seen that in Iraq, even a small group. And the Taliban managed to stand against the Americans and force the withdrawal. So yes, I think the U.S. Defense Secretary is quite right by saying it is just a big power, but it's a big power not able to reach the end, achieve anything at the end of the day.
Okay, well, Ian, there have always been different opinions in the U.S., like most places, but it was magnified greatly during the Trump era. How divided do you actually think the country is currently?
It's extremely divided. And I just want to add that the people who brought you the Iraq War were the people behind the Project for the New American Century. And they foresaw this precisely. In their own way, they were clear-sighted. They said America was declining economically, and so they had to cement in a military advantage now to ensure their hegemony over the next few years. And they're proved entirely right, apart from the fact of being hopelessly optimistic. And what we're seeing now is there's always been a problem with American foreign policy. It's never been, it's never been joined up. It's a result of different lobbies of forces within there. It's almost Byzantine in the way that the State Department, the Pentagon, the military industrial contractors, the politicians representing the lobbies, where they kick things around until it comes. And then, in the past, you had the State Department acting like a gyroscope and saying, well, yes, you might want that, but international law says no. Jerusalem is not Israel's capital. Or international law says no, Western Sahara is not part of Morocco, no matter what the President of the United States says. But that type of moderating influence is almost gone, because one of the things that Trump and the ideologues did was to wage a complete war against the State Department and the more rational aspects of the American foreign policy establishment. So in that sense, what Joe Biden has done is entirely rational. He said we can't win in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not one of our essential, it's not one of our essential fields of operation for the United States. The United States interests are not inextricably bound up there. Prestige might be, but we can live with their prestige. We're still the biggest military in the world. And then, the old story about sticks and stones may break my bones, but the names will let me. Okay, I'm not the big superpower. Try anything on me and see what I do. It's a rational position that Biden has taken, but it is symbolic of American decline and the decline of the decision-making apparatus that universally the political, military, and intelligence people let Biden down so thoroughly that he did not know that the Taliban had basically entered into an agreement and they bought the Afghan army wholesale on the ground, unit by unit.
You talked about that it's the logical thing to do, the rational thing to do. I think probably the question, though, for the American people and much of the world would be the way that they did what they did and why that they leave in the way that they did and cause such chaos. And what does that do to the American psyche itself? Because the American people, first of all, don't like to believe that they've been beaten, that they've lost the war, number one. And second of all, they don't like to hear that some have been left behind and basically American troops are running out of Afghanistan. I mean, what has that done in general for the American psyche inside of the country?
The American psyche, as far as I can see, is completely unflappable. Really, they really don't care. Afghanistan is a faraway country with a strange-sounding name, and most Americans are just happy to get out of there. Some of them might see it as a blot on their escutcheon, another way of looking at it, if you're being rational, bearing in mind that it was a completely unprecedented collapse, that was the real failure, the fact that that wasn't anticipated. The U.S. showed its power. It got out over 100,000 people in a very short time from allegedly a hostile territory with very few casualties and very few left behind. It's shameful, but actually that shame is mostly brought on by the Trump people who brought about the debacle to begin with, who are picking on Biden for partisan points. I'm not a fan of Biden, but this was one of the more rational things, and a lot of what he's been accused of goes squarely back to Donald Trump and the Republicans who started this thing. Now, Biden was one of the cheerleaders for those foreign adventures as part of the sort of neocon conspiracy to defend Israel. But on this particular aspect, he was clear-sighted. We couldn't win in Afghanistan. We have to get out.
Elijah, your assessment of it all, and what do you see as the main causes of the U.S.'s deterioration?
I think there are many points here. It is not only the rush that the U.S. left Afghanistan. It is only also the behavior toward the allies. I mean, here, Europe is under shock to see how the U.S. withdrew without even consulting Europe, and the way they withdrew without talking to the allies. And this is why we're here today to talk about the necessity to form a European army, which is very early, and I don't know where this is going to lead us. However, the reason why the U.S. felt in such a hurry to leave is because they had a wrong information, a wrong assessment of the army that they have trained, and they had a very high expectation.
How does that happen? Sorry to jump in here, Elijah. I mean, how does that happen? You say wrong assessment. 20 years. 20 years on the ground, 20 years American troops working or being side by side with Afghan troops, obviously evaluating the situation. How do you get it so wrong after 20 years?
Because the Americans make mistakes after mistakes. This is not the first time. And when because they lack also the understanding of the culture, they made this mistake in Iraq severely, and they did it again in Afghanistan, when they expected to see the Afghan army engage in a civil war against other Afghani while they are negotiating with them in Qatar and delivering the country back to the Taliban. And they expect the army to fight and give them just 6 months' time so they can pull out all the Americans and the Afghan collaborators. And they say, done, we are out, and now you can continue fighting until you kill each other, and Taliban will again overwhelm all the army that we've trained for 20 years. This is a real failure that we've seen also in Iraq in 2014, where they've trained the army for 11 years, and the Iraqi army crumbled in just 3 days in Mosul and in the north of Iraq. It is not only the failure of the intelligence services, it is not the lack of visibility and right assessment, it is not only the non-understanding of the state and the local culture. It is just everything was going wrong. And because they think, the Americans think, we can import our culture anywhere we go, this is fundamentally wrong. They are never going to change the culture of a country, and it's never going to be customized to the Americans' culture and mentality. Nobody asked the Americans to come, and nobody asked, and they were forced to leave after 20 years. They removed the Taliban in 2001 to give back the power in 2021 again to the Taliban.
Ian, even during a pandemic and health crisis, we have seen anything but solidarity in the way the American society has approached the issue. I mean, do you attribute this to a major mistrust by many of their leadership overall? And how does this affect the whole, the schism that has come about inside of the country? Is there overall mistrust for the leadership?
Well, I mean, you quoted at the beginning Francis Fukuyama, who wrote just before the end of the Cold War about after the end of the Cold War about the end of history, when in fact history had just restarted where it was left off in 1914. And to give him his due, Francis Fukuyama has admitted he was wrong about that thesis. And here, in effect, we're seeing the American Civil War still continuing after 160 years. I mean, the issues of race and privilege and culture are still hugely predominant here. I mean, we have Texas just passed an act which basically encourages vigilantism against women. We have almost post-Reconstruction states legislatures all over the South enacting legislation that makes it almost impossible for minorities and poor people to vote. And this is being done without interference on the federal level. We have uh, we, we have a party which tried to stage a coup against its own government on January the 6th. We have a failed president who's proclaiming he still won. These are not the hallmarks of a sophisticated and balanced society. This is the society that's riven down the middle, and there are people who hate each other. You know, 40% of Americans don't believe you can be patriotic and a Democrat. They certainly don't believe you can be patriotic and a socialist. They have their own very peculiar definitions, and it's a society that's based on exclusion and hatred on their part. They're actually dying in thousands because they think that wearing masks is a form of subservience to socialism, to galloping communism. They're refusing vaccinations in the middle of a death-dealing plague. I mean, you know, it's difficult. The German word is Schadenfreude, to take pleasure of the misfortunes and others. But I can't help grinning every time I see the latest right-wing radio commentator dying of COVID after he's run his latest rampage about vaccination and masks. They're still dying, though. Until they hit the hospital bed and the tubes are rammed down their throats, what's coming the other way out of their throats are invocations to resist the government, resist masks, watch out for those Democrats, they're coming after your daughters and everything else. It really is a very sick society, and it goes back to the Civil War, but it was Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan who saw those fissures were still there and started the process of enlarging the fissures, of basically playing the race card, which they've done year after year. And now it's an even bigger, it's a culture card, where, you know, any minorities are the target for vilification and witch hunts. It's not a stable society. And what's worse is that the people who actually make the decisions in Washington, the last 20 years of hollowing out by the Republicans, they've taken away. For years, if you spoke Arabic in the State Department, you were denied promotion. And you were talking about how could they. When the Shah was driven out of Tehran, U.S. mission people were still sending back rosy reports because none of them read Farsi. They didn't see all the graffiti on the street walls saying death to the Shah on their way in. They probably thought it was an advert for Coca-Cola. They did not know what was happening in the country they were stationed in because of their cultural arrogance.
Well, what about that, Elijah? I mean, now when we look at the situation and the overall situation of the U.S., many will say that it's a dying empire. It's under lots of pressure right now as far as its so-called prestige in the world. Other analysts will say it's some of the most dangerous times when an empire feel pressured. Your take on where this can go with the United States basically waning, as Ian said at the beginning, it may be waning, but it still has a lot of power. Your assessment of it at this point in time?
I think we are in a very dangerous situation today. The danger comes from an administration that wants to show that it has not been defeated and it still had the power to do something. And that will take us to the possibility of American just supporting another war somewhere or a battle between in West Asia. Secondly, the Americans, if they are smart enough to understand that they cannot sustain a presence in country where there is no interest to stay, like, for example, in northeast Syria, that is even exactly the same as Afghanistan, is so far, there is no interest for the Americans to stay there. It's staying in Iraq when the population, half of the population at least, is against them and carrying attack. So if they reach this realization that it is time to stop being involved in country that are far, there is no interest for the American, and they have to withdraw, then the world will be really in a better shape.
Okay.
Otherwise, you see, really an American administration committing one mistake after another.
All right, and on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this Spotlight. Senior Analyst Foreign Policy and Focus Ian Williams out of New York, and Journalist and Political Analyst Elijah McNair out of Brussels. And we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Birds that travel long distances can disperse seeds far and wide. An assessment of the timing and direction of the European bird migration reveals how these patterns might affect seed dispersal as the planet warms, says Barnabas H. Deru, researcher, in an article published under the heading Migratory Birds Aid Redistribution of Plants to New Climates. Stay tuned for more. The rapid pace of global warming and its effects on the habitats raise the question of whether species are able to keep up so that they remain in suitable living conditions. Some animals can move fast to adjust to a swiftly changing climate. Plants, being less mobile, rely on means such as seed dispersal by animals, wind or water, to move to new areas. But this redistribution typically occurs within 1 kilometer of the original plant. Writing in Nature, Gonzalez Varro et al. Shed light on the potential capacity of migratory birds to aid seed dispersal. When the climate in a plant's usual range becomes hotter than it can tolerate, it must colonize new cooler areas that might lie many kilometers away. It is not fully clear how plants distribute their seeds across great distances, let alone how they cross geographical barriers. One explanation for long-distance seed dispersal is through transport by migratory birds. Such birds ingest viable seeds when eating fruit and can move them tens or hundreds of kilometers outside the range of a plant species. In this mode of dispersal, the seeds pass through the bird's digestive tract unharmed and are deposited in feces. which provides fertilizer that aids plant growth. In the case of European migratory birds, for example, the direction of seed dispersal will depend on whether the timing of fruit production coincides with the bird's southward trip to warmer regions around the equator or northward to cooler regions. Many aspects of this process have been a mystery until now. Gonzalez Varro and colleagues report how plants might be able to keep pace with rapid climate change through the help of migrating birds. The authors analyze the fruiting times of plants, patterns of bird migration, and the interactions between fruit-eating birds and fleshy fruited plants across Europe. Plants with fleshy fruits were chosen for this study because most of their seed transport is by migratory birds, and because fleshy-fruited plants are an important component of the woody plant community in Europe. The common approach until now has been to predict plant dispersal and colonization using models fitted to abiotic factors, such as the current climate. Gonzalez Varro et al. Instead analyzed an impressive data set of 949 different seed dispersal interactions between bird and plant communities, together with data on entire fruiting times and migratory patterns of birds across Europe. The researchers also analyzed DNA traces from bird feces to identify the plants and birds responsible for the seed dispersal. The authors hypothesized that the direction of seed migration depends on how the plants interact with migratory birds, the frequency of these interactions, or the number of bird species that might transport seeds from each plant species. Gonzalez Varro and colleagues found that 86% of plant species studied might have seeds dispersed by birds during their southward trip towards drier and hotter equatorial regions in autumn, whereas only about one-third of the plant species might be dispersed by birds migrating north in spring. This dispersal trend was more pronounced in temperate plants than in Mediterranean plant communities examined. These results are in general agreement with well-known patterns of fruiting times and bird migrations. For example, the fruit of most fleshy-fruited plants in Europe ripens at a time that coincides with when birds migrate south towards the equator. Perhaps the most striking feature of these inferred seed movements is the observation that 35% of plant species across European communities, which are closely related on the revolutionary tree, might benefit from long-distance dispersal by the northward journey of migratory birds. This particular subset of plants tends to be fruit over a long period of time, or has fruits that persist over the winter. This means that the ability of plants to keep up with climate change could be shaped by their evolutionary history, implying that future plant communities in northern hemisphere will probably come from plant species that are closely related and that have migrated from the south. Or, to put it another way, the overwhelming majority of plant species that are dispersed fast toward drier and hotter regions at the equator will probably be less able to keep pace with rapid climate change in their new locations than will the few winners that are instead dispersed north to cooler climates. determine which birds might be responsible for the plant redistributions to cooler climates in the north, the authors categorize European bird migrants into Paleoarctic, those that fly to southern Europe and northern Africa during their non-breeding season, and Afro-Paleoarctic, those that winter in sub-Saharan Africa. Only a few common Paleoarctic migrants, such as the black cap, or Sylvia antricapilla, or blackbird Turdus merula, provide most of this crucial dispersal service northwards to cooler regions across Europe. Because migratory birds are able to relocate a small, non-random subset of plants, this could well have a strong influence on the types of plant community that will form under climate change conditions. A major problem, however, is that the role of these birds is dispersing seeds over long distances is already at risk from human pressures and environmental changes. Understanding these large-scale seed dispersal interaction offers a way for targeted conservation actions to protect the areas that are most vulnerable to climate change. And this could include boosting protection efforts in and around the wintering grounds of migratory birds, locations that are already experiencing a rise in human pressures such as illegal bird hunting. Gonzalez, Varro and colleagues' focus on seed dispersal across a northern hemisphere region means that, as with most ecological analysis, the results are dependent on scale, which can cause issues when interpreting data. Because the northern hemisphere has more land area and steeper seasonal temperature gradients than the southern hemisphere does, seed dispersal interactions might have different patterns from those occurring in southern hemisphere or in aquatic systems. For example, seed-eating birds from the genus Squally migrate from southern hemisphere to spend the dry season in equatorial West Africa, then move southwards again when the rains arrive. Their arrival in southern Africa usually coincides with the end of the wet season in this region, when annual grass seeds are in abundance. It will be worth investigating whether migratory birds in the southern hemisphere also influence the redistribution of plant communities during global warming. Likewise, exploring the long-distance dispersal of seeds of aquatic plants, such as seagrasses, by water birds is another area for future research that might benefit from Gonzalez, Varro and colleagues' methods. This study provides a great example of how migratory birds might assist plant redistribution to new locations that would normally be difficult for them to reach on their own and which might offer a suitable climate. As the planet warms, understanding how such biological mechanisms reorganize plant communities complements the information available from climate projection models, which offer predictions of future species distributions.
Of beautiful.
beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.